This must have something.
We're going to open our committee hearing today on the Senate Committee on Rural Communities and Economic Development, and it is February 13th. It was posted yesterday. Our birthday of our state, and it's really great that we can talk about issues that are dear to our state, and that is agriculture and parks, and we have a whole bunch of things today. So, but I want to tell people a little bit about the order because of the timing we do. We're going to open right at the beginning a public hearing on Senate Bill 19 to take testimony from Senator Monis Anderson. And then we're going to go to our a work session on committee bill introduction, and we'll talk a little bit more about that when we do that. And then we'll start, we'll do a work session on Senate Bill 324. That was a bill that we heard yesterday. We didn't have all the paperwork for the last session. We didn't have all the paperwork. It has to do with EMTs and rural people getting a tax credit that we have to send to the tax credit committee. Then we'll go into the informational meeting on the canola. We'll then come back to our Senate Bill 19 public hearing. And then we'll go to our 331 public hearing at the end. So that's kind of the order of business for the day, so people kind of know what's going on. So with that information, we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 19, and we're going to have a short explanation from our administrator about the bill. We'll do that again and have Senator Monis Anderson come on up to give her testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 19 amends the definition of rural area to mean area outside urban growth boundary, as the boundary is acknowledged on the date on which an application is submitted for the strategic investment program. It grandfathers strategic investment zones designated on or before December 31st, 2012, and land parcels where the eligible project is located on December 31st, 2012.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for hearing this bill. It's a bill that's extremely important to me and to East Multnomah County. I'm Senator Lori Monis Anderson, and I represent Gresham, Troutdalewood Village, and Fairview, and some of East Portland. Economic development is vital to my area, and we do have a great team that's working on bringing new businesses to our area. Right now, we in East Multnomah County are at a disadvantage with the west side of the Tri-County area. Senate Bill 19 will make our strategic investment program, SIP, much fairer and allow lands within an urban area and inside a UGB to be on equal footing. As the program stands now, lands within an urban growth boundary but added after 2002 are defined as rural for SIP purposes. This places an unfair advantage to urban lands added before 2002, or it actually is an unfair advantage to urban lands added after 2002 compared to the lands added to the UGB before 2002. We in Gresham and East County are at extreme disadvantage when we are wooing new industry to our area when it comes to the SIP SIP program. We have shovel-ready land, and we have already two semiconductor industries, Microchip and ON Semiconductor, and we have lands connected to them that are ready to go. But when industries come, they look at, say, the Hillsborough area that has land within their UGB and is definitely an urban area that can provide a greater incentive to them. We're not on a level playing field when, and in the last 10 years, from 2002 to now, these lands that are considered rural in the SIP program really are not rural. They are definitely urban. So we need some help. And when a jurisdiction can offer incentives of a cap on assessed value at $25 million, which Hillsborough area can, and we can only offer an incentive of a cap on assessed value of $100 million, we just can't compete because an industry is going to definitely go with the $25 million cap. This would help, say, rural areas in Grants Pass or Coos Bay, instead of going to Hillsborough, they could actually go to your area. Anyway, I don't like the fight between Hillsborough, which I love and I visited often, but this SIP should be truly helping rural areas where we really need economic development, and we need a level playing field for those of us that have land within the urban growth boundary. So thank you very much, and I know that there are some people that will be testifying on this for you and to you, and so I have to get back to chair my committee. But I do hope that you really take a look at the fairness of how our SIP is with that date of 2002. Thank you very much.
Any questions?
Just a real quick one, because I know. So,
Senator Brett Sugar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, so it sounds to me it's the date is what pays the, you know, it's if you came before or after, and that's, if we remove the date, we would be there.
It would be a level playing field for those of us in the urban, having land within the urban growth boundary.
Thank you, Senator.
Senator Burt.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for bringing this to us, because I wasn't even aware of it. It seems kind of ludicrous on its face that you would set an arbitrary date and say something that's rural on this date is rural in perpetuity. It just, on its face, Gresham's issues aside. But, you know, there's also another issue involved here, and that is we have a gain share program in place. And so if you skew the definition of rural versus urban and give the bigger tax breaks to people who are in artificially designated rural areas, you also make a bigger hit on the general fund.
Well, this change would actually line it up, and again, I can have the experts talk to you with the enterprise zone statute, and so we're hoping to.
Well, I think if I can follow up, Mr. Chair, I think your bigger point is it's just it doesn't make sense to have an artificial date, because things do not stay frozen in time, and and we do want to encourage development in rural areas, and we want to have a level playing field in the urban areas. So thank you for bringing this.
Well, thank you for listening. All right.
Any further questions? None. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and I apologize.
I'll close the hearing for now. We'll be opening it again a little later. And I want to say, just so some people who aren't here often, whenever there's a senator or a representative who has another meeting going on at the same time, we defer to that, and that's why this little shuffle of what's happening today. Next, we're going to open a work session to introduce some committee measures. This is said before each committee when you do this. There are bills that come to us, and we introduce them. That does not mean that I like any or all of these bills. It doesn't mean that any of the people who vote for them at this time like any of them. It just puts them into the system so that then we can have conversations about them. But it is the way we can introduce bills from a committee as opposed from individual members, and that's why we do it. Most of the committees have opportunity to do this from time, but I just want to make sure for everybody's purposes, so they didn't each have to define that, yeah, they'll vote for it, but they don't particularly like this, that, or whatever. None of us up here are claiming that we are in favor or opposed to any of the particular bills that we're entering as committee bills. So with that, Senator Birch.
Mr. Chair, I move that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 3669, dated February 5th, 2013. LC 3174, dated January 30th, 2013. And LC 3434, dated February 12th, 2013.
So, Senator Batsugar moves the following LCs be introduced as committee bills: LC 3669, dated February 5th, 2013, LC 3174, dated January 30th, 2013, and LC 3434, dated February 12th, 2013. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered. And that closes that work session. We're now going to open a work session on Senate Bill 324, and we'll have a short explanation of the bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 324 extends the sunset from January 1st, 2014 to January 1st, 2020 for tax credit for emergency medical service providers for the provision of volunteer emergency medical services in rural areas. The revenue statement has been issued, and there is a minimal fiscal impact.
And for those of us, when we had the discussion, one of the concerns was maybe it should be a little higher because we seem to be losing some of these volunteers in some of the rural areas. The total number has gone down a little bit. We checked, and the average use of this one is about $244. So we're not sure that it helps. And we talked with Senator Bearsugar, actually checked back with some of his EMTs, and they couldn't use it at all. So it because of income and stuff. So we have some issues about some of those things, but it seems to be in a kind of that place. But I would hope that when it gets to your committee in the Joint Tax Committee, that maybe you can look at that and see if there are other ways to incentivize some of those people to be the volunteers and do the work that they do in our rural areas. So with that, I would entertain a motion.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 324 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Joint Tax Credits by prior reference.
Senator Bearsugar moves Senate Bill 324 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the Committee on Joint Tax Credits by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So moved. And we put that in your fine hands, Senator Bergen, because we all really believe this is a good tax credit. So
it will be treated very respectfully, Mr.
Okay. Thank you very much. With that, we will open an informational meeting on the canola rulemaking, and we will invite Katie Kova, Director of ODA, and her team.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Katie Kova, Director of the Oregon Department of Agriculture. With me is my Deputy Director, Lisa Hansen, and Assistant Director, Lauren Henderson. And I've asked them to join. They've been very involved as we have deliberated on this issue for many, many years. And as we're going through and answering questions, they may have some context to provide for you as well. The topic before you this afternoon is canola. And I would start out by saying that this has probably been the most difficult issue that I've had to deal with in my tenure as Director of the Department of Agriculture. I think the agency has been extremely thoughtful and diligent and persistent in trying to find common ground between people that are interested in growing canola in the Willamette Valley and those that are opposed to growing canola in the Willamette Valley. And I believe the agency has been very focused on trying to find the right place on this issue. Our whole effort over the course of approximately 8 years that we've been working on this issue has been to bring the two sides together to try to find common ground. And unfortunately, despite all our best efforts, despite the inordinate amount of time that several folks on our staff have put into this discussion, we have not been able to find a place where the two sides could agree. You have before you today a rule which we filed last week, and we'll be going through that rule, not in detail, but I'll give you an overview and then we can do our best to answer your questions. But there is not consensus on this rule. We filed it last week because we thought then that would give the legislature at least a starting point as you begin your deliberations on dealing with this issue. I want to mention, before we go into detail, there's been two very, very important principles that we have tried to have in front of mind as we have struggled with this issue. And the first one is one that I think is going to be a challenge that we in agriculture face more and more as we look into the future. This is an issue that's not just solely in the purview of the state of Oregon, but is really on the forefront of many national discussions as well in the agriculture in the arena, and that is the principle of coexistence. certainly the state of Oregon probably is facing this maybe sooner or in more intensity than some other states because of the diversity of our agricultural production. But the whole idea behind coexistence is to have those producers, farmers, and ranchers that are farming near each other to work together, to communicate with each other, to find resolutions to their issues. And you have coexistence not only in between canola growers and specialty seed producers, but you certainly have canola or coexistence issues when you think about GMO and organic, or conventional farming and organic, or even land use issues. Someone that's operating a winery next to someone that's a producer, and if you have someone having a wedding on a given day and they don't want the tractor driving next door to interfere with the wedding, certainly around water use. So clearly, where we have potential for conflicts within the industry or even do have conflicts within the industry, I think it's very, very important and incumbent upon the industry to try to strive towards coexistence, to communicate with each other and try to resolve their differences in that manner. The second key principle that we kept front of mind as we were working on this issue is, what is the right role for state government in trying to sort through the place where we should land? We have statutory authority to establish control areas. And interestingly enough, in that authority, it even mentions specifically that the department should operate justly and fairly and not arbitrarily. And so this whole notion of what is the right place for state government versus the private sector has been another issue that we've tried to really keep front of mind as we have worked on a canola rule. There are clearly, I would say, two sides to the issue, and I'm simplifying, probably describing those sides, but in general, the one side is those who are interested in growing canola, and primarily these are grass seed growers or wheat growers in the Willamette Valley that are looking at canola as a rotation crop, break up disease cycles, for grass or wheat producers. And they have found canola to be very much so an economically viable rotation crop for them. The folks that are opposed to the production of canola in the Willamette Valley are very concerned about a very valuable specialty seed industry that we have in the valley. It's one of the premier places in the world where we can grow specialty seed, which is a very high value crop, as well as individuals that are organic producers in the Willamette Valley. Where we have ended up in the rule is really an effort to try to minimize risk to our specialty seed producers while allowing a small amount of canola to be grown in the Willamette Valley. So I'm going to attempt to make sense of the rule. You have it in front of you in your packet. I am not going to go through in detail what it means, but I want to start, if I can, with the map that's included in your packet. And then we're going to refer to a second map. And we have created thousands of maps in our agency as we've worked through this issue. So kind of maps are us. But if you'll go first to this map in your packet, which is a red square within a which there's a purple area and a green area. The red square on your map represents the current area where canola is not allowed to be produced in the Willamette Valley. So this is really where we kind of started in our deliberations, and what is included in your rule are two zones within this protected district. The purple zone represents about 1.9 million acres, and in the rule, this purple zone continues to be protected from growing canola. So farmers that have land in this area would not be allowed to grow canola in the purple zone. The green zone on the outside of that kind of core area of the valley would be acreage. It's about 1.7 million acres, where there could be potential for growing canola. So what would happen in the process is farmers that are interested in growing canola would need to submit a request to the department by July 15th of every year. And we are limiting the amount of canola that could be grown in the green area to a maximum of 2,500 acres. If we got requests above and beyond that 2,500 acres, the department would ultimately make the decision about up to a 2,500-acre max, what acreage could be planted in canola. In addition, within the rule, there are very strict management practices that these growers would have to adhere to. They would enter into a contract with the department whereby they would agree to adhere to these management practices. And I have to tell you, I believe these are probably the strictest management practices that a state entity, a state agency, certainly the Department of Agriculture, has ever imposed on someone growing a crop within the state of Oregon. And these would be practices such as cleaning equipment. If you're in a canola field and you're handling canola, you'd have to thoroughly clean your equipment before you move out of that field. Covering canola seed if you're transporting it. If you have seed that grows in the following your production and your crop along ditches or roadways, you would be required to clean that up. Growers would have to pay a fee to the department, which the department would use to administer the program, as well as do some spot check monitoring and respond to complaints if the department receives complaints about growers that are not adhering to their management practices. There is also a minimum acreage size for a field of canola, where the minimum size would be 25 acres. And the thinking behind that is fewer, larger fields of canola would be easier to manage and control than more smaller fields of canola. So hence the 25-acre minimum per field. Just want to make sure. I do want to also mention, before we go to this other map, that through the course of our deliberations, we have been in very close communication with Oregon State University. From 2006 to 2009, the legislature funded some research that we contracted with Oregon State University on this topic, and it was really to look at the potential for canola to be weedy, to spread, as well as pest and disease issues associated with canola. In addition, the Oregon State University worked with the specialty seed industry and created an electronic pinning system. So what you, and we'll speak to pinning in a minute. And then also did some research around potential alternatives to canola, other kinds of crops that could be used as a rotation crop for grass seed and wheat growers in the valley. That research was discontinued in 2009 because of budget cuts. I think if Oregon State University was sitting here, they would feel that additional research is necessary to thoroughly and better understand ramifications of canola and its impact on specialty seed producers. In the course of our deliberations over the last fall, one of the many advisory groups that we worked with strongly suggested that research be funded again. So in December, the department came to the emergency board requesting the startup of research as well, and $446,000 request that would fund research over a three-year time period. The emergency board at that time chose to defer that request to this legislative session. And so I think as we continue to discuss canola, it would be very important to keep in mind the sense that starting up and continuing that research is a high priority for those of us involved with this issue. What I'd like to do, if I could, is refer you now to this map in front of you, and it's a map with an overlay with a bunch of dots on it. this map is a little different than the one that you have in your packet. And what you have is the red square within that. You can see another outline that really is showing the protected district. And then also on this map, you see white area and green area within that square. The green area in this drawing represents soils that have been identified as class 1 through 4 soils. And these would be soils where you could viably grow canola crop. The white area in this are something beyond class 1 through 4 soils. So realistically, you're not looking at being able to grow canola in the white parts of this map. So I think what this demonstrates for you is, even though in the other box where you've got the green that is open to the production of canola, in reality you're looking at some fairly limited areas within the canola growing zone where you could actually grow it. And you're looking at spots to the west of Salem, to the east and south of Salem, up in Washington County. And those, I think, are where we expect we would get the request to grow canola. The overlay that you have is the information that we've received from the Willamette Valley Specialty Seed Association's electronic pinning map, which represents a historical 3 years worth of pinning of specialty seeds in the valley. And so when someone wants to grow specialty seeds, they go into this electronic system and they basically pin the location. And there are rules within the Willamette Valley Specialty Seed Association about isolation distances, so that if you're growing a radish seed at this pin, you would have to have, I believe it's up to 3 miles before you could grow another kind of specialty seed, in order to maintain that isolation distances and minimize or prevent cross-pollination. So we share this with you to show you, in essence, where we have drawn the protected zone where canola could not be grown. It represents the majority of specialty seed production over the last 3 years in the Willamette Valley. It does not protect all of it, but the majority is through that core area in the valley. And then you can see where there could be places you could grow canola. There is specialty seed being grown now, and that's where we would expect and we know is a source of continued conflict and concern around coexistence between canola production and specialty seed production. So with that, I think I'm going to pause and see what kind of questions we've generated.
So, committee, questions? Senator Brzezinski.
So, Katie, I appreciate your presentation at this point. I hope there's going to be more to it than just what I've heard. The coexistence, of course, is a great, let's say, mantra for us as a state to do it, but there may be times where coexistence just doesn't work. And is the department in a position that it's going to move forward something on a basis of theory of coexistence, or is the department has it taken position in the past where coexistence is shown to be too chancy, too iffy as to what the let's say the ramifications could be if we're wrong?
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Brzezinski, I think our rule demonstrates that we don't believe if you open up the valley and have no restrictions on the planting of canola that in that instance coexistence would work. Hence, you have a rule which identifies places where you cannot grow canola, and then there are some places where you can grow canola, and in those places where it can be grown, we will strongly encourage growers in those areas to communicate and work together and do everything they can to minimize risk in this situation. So I would say that our rule truly kind of reflects both of those. We still have a zone where production is not allowed, and then we have an area where production is allowed, but we're going to strongly encourage producers to work together in those areas.
Fine, follow up.
Yes.
Are you familiar with the article that was in Oregon's Agricultural Progress, winter 2013, regarding canola I believe one of the researchers. Let me first ask if one of the researchers is Carol Mallory Smith. Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with the article that was prepared and put into that Extension Service magazine as to the positions? That appears from my reading of it that they're taking a caution, researchers conclude, is still the watchword, and that at this point they're thinking that, for my interpretation of this, maybe we should be doing more research before we actually open the box to find out later that, oops, we made a mistake, and a specialty seed industry has now been compromised.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Prozonsky, Carol Mallory Smith and Russ Caro were the two individuals from Oregon State University that we were in communication with as we deliberated and developed this rule. I certainly would not speak for them, but we talked to them about this rule and specifically asked whether they thought this would be protective enough of the specialty seed industry, and basically their answer was yes, they felt it would be.
I appreciate that. I would ask the chair at some point, since we're going to have, I know, at least one bill that I've signed on to as to, let's say, not allowing this to occur until we have better certain outcomes, to have the researchers here so we can actually go through their research. I appreciate the department taking the position and relying on using that, but based on my reading of this, it seems like they still got some caution and they're concerned, and my concern is that we've got a specialty seed industry here, and we haven't heard how much their economic impact is for the state, but my understanding is pretty significant. We have a very, I think, a duty to ensure that we do not jeopardize that industry to the point of where cross-pollination occurs, and we basically now have impure seed or product that is at that point, let's say, doesn't have the advantage that it currently has in the market area.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Kova, I'm interested sort of in the history. I know you've been with the agency many years. What is the history of this type of conflict between, you know, various types of seeds? Have we had this before, or is this a new development?
Mr. Chair, Senator Close, I think it's fair to say that, A, the specialty seed industry has really developed over the course of the last 10 years. There's no question that this is a premier growing region for specialty seed production, and we do have places, other places in the world where specialty seed has lost its value or gone out of business, in some cases because of a large acreage amount of canola being produced. So we know this is a very, very sensitive and difficult issue, but the value of specialty seed in Oregon has really grown over the last decade. And we also have places in central Oregon, northeast Oregon, and along the Oregon-Idaho border where we grow specialty seed production. They also have control areas in place. Each one is a little different in terms of how they handle specialty seed production and canola. I think the other issue that has probably contributed to the complexity of this topic is the interest in the production of biodiesel and tax credits at the federal and state level, which provide support the growing of feedstock for biodiesel, of which canola is one of those, and tax credits, which have allowed that to then become a very economically viable crop. And that has also passed in the last 10 years. The research that Oregon State University identified some other potential crops as biofuel feedstock that could be grown in the valley. Camelina would be one example, but canola is still the crop that grows the best in these conditions and therefore is the most economically viable of some alternatives that have been identified. So there's kind of been this number of factors that have developed over the course of the last 10 years that have made it so challenging in the valley, and really not as many places around the U.S. that are dealing with these same kinds of variables that we are facing here.
So would it be fair to say this is the first time that you've dealt with, Oregon has dealt with this conflict between two types of seeds that are being planted?
I'm looking at Lisa and Lauren. So we've been dealing with this for probably 8 years. Prior to that, I think it's, maybe I should back up and then Lisa may chime in. The department has had control area authority on the books for a lot longer than that. And we have established control areas to deal with pests and diseases, which we know can negatively impact agricultural crops. This is unique in a way because canola is in a field of brassicas, which includes broccoli, cauliflower, kale, radish, turnip, where you've got one crop that can negatively impact another crop. So typically it's been a pest or disease that isn't a crop that negatively impacts another crop. So we have issued control areas and continue to do that. This is unique from that standpoint. The other challenge we have is that agriculture deals with pests and diseases all the time. So really when you use that control area authority, it's to deal with a pest or disease that is above and beyond what you would consider what you normally have to deal with in your day-to-day business. So it's, again, it's that using that authority cautiously, judiciously, not arbitrarily. And I think canola and specialty seed is very unique to the department, unlike anything else that we've had to deal with.
She wants to finish up, though, 1 second.
Okay. Chair Roblin, Senator Close.
Lisa
Hansen, Deputy Director with the Department of Agriculture. The other comparison that I would add, we have had a rape seed control area in the state for some time because historically there had been rape seed grown, but there were two types. There was an industrial type and there was a food grade type, and one of them had a high uric acid, and if they cross-contaminated, there were issues with the food grade type, and so there was a need to keep those separate. So there has been some experience in trying to keep varieties separate through the control areas. But
and for a lot of people, they don't recognize that rapeseed and canola are the same thing. Okay.
And just my last question, and maybe it's in your work somewhere, I haven't seen it, but what differentiates a specialty seed from, you know, a grain of wheat? I mean, what's the definition that makes that something specialty, whereas you know, our common grain crops are not specialty?
So specialty seed crops are crops that are specifically raised to harvest the seed and then sell that seed to raise that crop. So radish seed crop, you would raise it, harvest the seed, and then sell it to folks that want to raise radish, whether it's gardeners, larger scale producers kind of thing. So you're specifically raising the seed for production in the future, and that's why it needs to be of very high quality. And we have a reputation here in Oregon of having some of the highest quality specialty seeds in the world. Grain, on the other hand, is raised to be sold in the market to be turned into a food product. So there are those that raise grain for seed, and you would have those same issues in terms of cleanliness and purity and kind of a higher level of protection on that seed as opposed to something that's going to be eaten or go into food stock of some sort.
Thank you.
Part of the issue has been that canola, especially in Europe, has become a weed. So it's kind of taken over a lot of other areas. Two questions. One, we used to grow canola in the valley, and it seems to have gone. So, I mean, we are there tools that we can eradicate it regardless? And number two, radish is also a brassica, and it also has that same tendency, is my understanding, and yet it's grown in the valley now. I don't know to what extent, but it's obviously grown in the valley. And it has some of the same characteristics with respect to cross-pollination and others. So they've been able to control that, I guess is my question.
Mr. Chair, yes, canola was grown in the valley many, many years ago, and I think the reason it was probably discontinued is you couldn't make money at it. In Europe, what happened was, as I understand it, very large-scale production of canola, hundreds of thousands of acres. And when we started talking about this notion of the valley and can you allow canola, and if so, how much, I think the general sense is, and what Senator Przanski was referring to in the OSU article, is we believe there's a level of canola where you do jeopardize specialty seed production, but we just don't know what that number is. And so that's why OSU refers to being very cautious in terms of what you allow with acreage. And so certainly in the Willamette Valley, we're not interested in seeing hundreds of thousands of acres of canola being planted. I think there's no question in my mind that would devastate the specialty seed industry. What we're trying to figure out is what is that level where you can be cautious, minimize risk, and still allow a very important specialty seed industry to thrive in the Willamette Valley. That's what we've been struggling with. There are brassicas that are grown in the valley for use other than specialty seed. The one that I have heard used the most is turnip, growing at a larger acreage amount on turnip for forage. I'm not an expert on turnip. So there is concern there as well, the same kinds of issues in terms of pests, diseases. So it's not just canola, but any brassica that's grown on a large scale can result in that.
Senator Berkshire. Yes, two questions from Senator Berkshire. Sugar. There we go.
Well, you're going to get it down.
It's come normal for you.
Come
yeah.
June.
Yeah, come June. We'll have it down by June. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions for you. How long have we been growing canola on and off in the Willamette Valley?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to try to pronounce this name correctly.
And okay, good job.
Senator Bertschuger.
Good job.
Okay. We have not grown canola in the valley for feedstock for many, many years. My understanding is there is canola that's grown for seed in mm-hmm. the valley, but I can't tell you what the acreage size is for that. But I do know I had grass seed growers that indicated they had grown canola in the valley many, many years ago, and I'm going to say late 80s, but don't hold me to that because I honestly don't know. But
So we can say, you know, canola's been here and gone for 40 years, 30 years, something like that. Let's say that it's been around. How many instances have we had conflicts with specialty seed growers?
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Bertschuger, again, it comes back to my response to Senator Close. We've really seen over the last 10 years kind of an explosion in the Willamette Valley as a prime area for specialty seed industry. So back when there was canola being produced, I don't believe we had the level of specialty seed production that we do in the valley now. So hence you wouldn't have seen that same kind of conflict back then. But with the growth of that industry in the valley now, and frankly their great economic success, there's a lot more sensitivity around this topic than you would have had 20, 30, 40 years ago.
I guess what I'm getting, have we had instances of cross-pollination or have we had any of that going on even recently?
So, Mr. Chair, I should clarify, we have prohibited canola from being grown in the valley since 2005, I think.
2005.
So we've not tested it.
Okay. So we don't know if we've had any yet. Okay, thank you.
And I guess my other question is I look at the map and I agree with you. It's good to know that the white area is forests and the other area, so there's really not a lot of land. 2,500, is there any other crop that we've limited to 2,500 acres?
Mr. Chair, there is no other crop that the Oregon Department of Agriculture has limited at all, I'm aware of.
Okay, so radish and turnip aren't regulated with regard to the amount of acreage?
Nope.
Okay. It appears also that all the areas that are available, except maybe the Washington County, are dry farm? I mean, there, it doesn't look like irrigation there. The one up in Washington County might be, but the rest of them appear to be no irrigated lands.
Mr. Very Chairman, little. My guess would be the vast amount of acreage that you're looking at as possible location for production of canola would not be irrigated land. You might have a little bit out there, but certainly on the east side of Salem, you're into the Silverton Hills area.
And other than the Silverton Hills, which we still allow a little bit of field burning, mm-hmm. all the rest of it is we exempted from field burning, which was one of the avenues that grass our grass seed people and our grass used as a control technique.
Mr.
And
Chairman,
I understand this particular plant can help that same do some of the same kinds of things in a rotation.
That's correct. The Silverton Hills were exempted from the field burning ban because of the specialty kind of grass that they grow in the hills, and the fact that they are hills and burning is really about the only way you can deal with their issues. The rest of grass seed production in the Willamette Valley is banned from field burning, and growing canola is a very viable rotation crop for breaking up that pest disease cycle in grass seed.
Yes. Well, since we're going to go here, let's go here. So what steps has the Department of Ag taken to actually try to get industrial hemp legalized and on the federal side? I mean, we passed it here. It's on the books. It's a great rotation crop. It's been demonstrated that. So what steps has the department taken to try to get the definition redone? So, Ms. Koba, you seem to find that pretty funny. So what's so funny?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Prozanski, not funny in that sense, other than this is certainly an issue that you carried the bill.
That's exactly right, I did.
That's right. And I know that it is something that you'd very much like to see. The issue that we have clearly is the federal government does not allow production.
The question I had is, what steps have you taken as the director to try to move that forward? We do know that there's action within the Congress to move that forward, and I want to know what the department has, because this is a good rotational crop. It's one that's been demonstrated that it could actually be and has been viable in this valley as well.
Mr. Chair, Senator Prozanski, we have not been involved in working with Congress to get industrial hemp legalized.
So, Mr. Chair, I am going to ask the committee administrator to distribute this article, because where it says this study provides strong evidence that will be difficult to prevent the introduction of transgenic canola into an area, even where there is a provision of only to allow conventional canola to be produced in the valley, I think we've got a real risk here. And I'm very concerned that we're going to try to, quote-unquote, coexist just because we're trying to coexist instead of making certain before we reintroduce something in here and potentially ruin an industry that is demonstrated to be a very lucrative field for the state of Oregon.
Other questions? For our panel.
I think you got a copy.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
So we're going to close our informational hearing, and we're going to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 19. And we'll ask people, we've got one other one after this that has a number of people listed to speak, and we have about four people here. So we'll Mayor Jerry Wiley and Pat and Pam, if they want to come and be our first group. So we originally had this get started because Senator Amanda Sanderson has already given some testimony, so now we're back to the same bill that has to do with an issue about land use in the state of Oregon with respect to the definition of rural. So with that, please go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jerry Willey. I am the mayor of Hillsboro, and I have with me Pat Rebellia, who is a retired planning director that has decided he wants to nurture and mentor me in the political side of things. And I will let Pam introduce herself in a moment. We also have the Chamber of Commerce. The Hillsboro Chamber has submitted testimony as well, written testimony. We have provided that, as well as my letter has been submitted in addition. And for the record, we strongly oppose Senate Bill 19. As mayor, I spend a considerable amount of time in conferences and attending committee meetings, and a significant part of that time is spent on economic development and how do we provide an opportunity for our city and our state to get to yes, and that's, I guess, that's my definition of how do we become successful in the economic development competition, because that's precisely what it is. The state of Oregon has to be globally competitive to be successful. So in our region, we try very hard to make sure that we have land that is deemed shovel-ready, and by that, it means that we have provided concept planning, that we have evaluated the transportation needs and the infrastructure needs that will be attractive to potential suitors to come to our region, to come to our state and provide employment. We also know that these kinds of industries need adequate water, a good water supply. They need adequate power. And most importantly, they need an educated workforce. And so we know those are strong criteria to be in the first tier of getting recognition and getting on the list for consideration. Because if you don't make the first tier, you don't have an opportunity to even begin to talk about tax incentives. So we have spent a considerable amount of time and money trying to make our area ready and to get on the list. The removal of the date, as has been suggested simplistically, the removal of the date impacts 17 Oregon cities. It's not about leveling the playing field. It's about the elimination of a tax incentive for 17 cities at 30,000 population or above. Many of those cities are represented by you. We have to have the ability to have tax incentives in Oregon to be attractive for business recruitment. Currently, if we eliminate this incentive, we will not only eliminate the opportunity for existing consideration and companies that we are talking to, but these 17 cities will not have the ability in the future to add land inside their urban growth boundary for industrial and employment use and be able to use this as a tax incentive. Many of our rural communities, this incentive is $25 million. This is within reach for these companies that would consider our rural communities as places to develop and add employment. Without this, they will not have that incentive to be able to do that. They will lose some of their competitive edge. And remember that it's not about Hillsboro, it's not about Gresham, it's not about the Portland region. It's about the state of Oregon competing with Austin, Texas, and New York, and Indonesia, and China, and Japan. We are globally competitive. We have to be globally competitive. So in this process, we know that site selectors and other companies looking at Oregon pay attention to what our legislature does and the messages they send that would be encouragement to come to Oregon and invest their money. And they are paying attention to this process. And I think it's very important that we be careful of the message that we may be sending by trying to remove a tax incentive that may encourage them to come to Oregon. We have, without doubt, without the rural SIP, we would not have Genentech in Hillsboro. And for every job that is generated, no matter where it is in Oregon, there is about a 3-to-1 ratio of new jobs that is generated. So anything that we would do to inhibit that would have a significant ripple effect all over our state, and certainly in regards to the 17 cities that will be impacted. We have a real-life case study, if you want to narrow the scope down to Hillsboro and Gresham. We have a real-life case study that I can provide you with the statistics on it. That will show that when compared with the rural SIZ, the urban SIZ, that actually Gresham was more favorable in the overall outcome of that. And that's a real live example. So today, I encourage you to send a very strong message to any of the site selectors and any of the potential suitors that we have coming to Oregon, that Oregon is open for business and that we are doing everything that we can to be competitive in the global workplace to bring employment to Oregon. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin and members of the committee. My name is Pam Treese. I'm the Executive Director of Westside Economic Alliance, and I'm here to present testimony in opposition to Senate Bill 19. I've worked at the local, regional, and state level in economic development for many years. It's been our hallmark in this state for the development, for the economic development professionals to work together, to be collaborative. And that collaboration is what makes us effective against our competition. Our competition is, it's not each other. It is, as Mayor Willie represented, it's at a national level and it's at a global level. The this bill essentially undermines that collaboration and effectively reduces our opportunity to be competitive at the national and global level, now and into the future. In addition to that, do we really want to impact cities like Eugene, Springfield, Albany, Tigard, or Grants Pass in the if in the future there are changes to their urban growth boundaries that would eliminate the use of an economic development recruitment tool like the Rural Strategic Investment Program? And I really don't think we want to do that. The benefits gained by the location of a company anywhere within Oregon are not limited to the immediate jurisdiction where the company is located, but instead they provide opportunities throughout the region and to the state in tax dollars generated. For example, recent statistics show that 70% of the workers employed in Hillsboro live and commute throughout the metropolitan area, including East Multnomah County. Chair Roblin, I urge you and the committee to consider the impact of this potential legislation. During the rebuilding phase of our great state and into the future, we need more tools to bring jobs to Oregon, not fewer tools. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chairman Roblin and committee members, I just want to embellish.
Make sure you make.
My name is Pat Rebellia, City of Hillsboro. To speak to the date issue that's in the bill as it currently is written. If the date were taken out, as the bill and the statute currently says, you can only apply the rural SIP outside the urban growth boundary. So that precludes whatever jurisdiction chooses to apply it in the future, or if this bill is adopted, that precludes a lot of urban industrial uses. outside the UGB. That's the current situation now. The date, whether it's fortuitous or intentional or unintentional, has the benefit of opening up cities now or in the future that have urban industrial land in the UGB brought into the boundary after 2002 to the use of this tool. That's in our experience in Hillsborough, that's been a very important tool. But it is not, it's been our experience, it is not the decisive tool for companies. What companies look for first is, do they have a site in Oregon, wherever it may be, that meets their needs, their business needs? If they do find a site, wherever that jurisdiction is, what the value of the rural SIP has been, at least in our cases, it's been the ability to make that site even more competitive relative to sites in other parts of the region or in other countries. So it's, in the case of Genentech, it was the deal closer. There was another state that was hotly in competition for it. But Genentech wanted the site in the first place. So I wanted to clarify that whether it's intentional or unintentional, that 2002 date really has a potential benefit to all cities that, whether they're now over 30,000 people or in the future, if they add land into the UGB in the future, this creates the opportunity for them to use that tool. That's why our focus has been to say, this is a statewide tool that's very important. Yes, it's important to Hillsborough, but it's important throughout the state potentially, especially as to those kinds of communities. Thank you.
Questions for this panel? Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, I mean, no one's disputing the fact that this has been a good economic tool. But what is the magic of the year 2002? I mean, you could have areas that the intent of the differentiation between the urban and rural was to encourage development in truly rural areas. So how, you know, you look at Genentech, for example, which is in an area that was urbanized after 2002, as I understand, how do you know that they wouldn't have come with a higher threshold?
Again, Genentech wanted the site in the first instance. But as I recall, having been part of that conversation while at the city, we were in hot competition with another state, a city in another state. The tool itself, because the land was brought in to the boundary after 2002, I think it was 2002. The tool itself, again, as I said, helped close the deal. It wasn't the factor that made them choose us over the other city. It was the factor that finally put us in the winning category for Genentech.
The difference between $25 million and $100 million, that's what made the difference?
Yeah, because as I recall, I'm not sure they made the $100 million threshold at that time. It was initial investment.
So what you're saying then is that there, as a matter of policy, there should be no difference in the treatment of rural areas and urban areas?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that what the date has, again, whether it's intentional or unintentional, the date has created opportunities for the cities that have or will add land to the UGB for industrial use after the date of 2002.
And it's helped them compete more successfully against areas that were urbanized earlier and might have very similar characteristics.
Perhaps.
That's right.
Yeah. Thank you.
Other questions for this panel?
Not have those characteristics.
No. Okay. Thank you very much for being here. As we have the next group coming up, Ron Rapsdorf and Travis Stovall. I will also mention that we have today visiting new county commissioners from around the state who are having the opportunity to be here and see what's going on. So if you want to stand, we'll say thanks for being here, because I think it's really great to have different people. And I think there's more than this. These are, yes, thank you all. So. Oh, okay. So, yes.
Chair Roblin, thank you for the opportunity to be here. Ron Papsdorf with the City of Gresham. Mayor Bemis sends his regards. He really wanted to be here today. He owns a restaurant in Gresham. Valentine's Day is probably one of, if not the busiest day for him of the year. Mr. Chair, Vice Chair, I want to start by saying that we have no pleasure in bringing this issue before this body today. We had hoped to find an agreeable solution with the City of Hillsborough and Washington County, our friends and partners. Mayor Willie and I have done economic development recruitment together. We agree on 90% of what he said to you already today in terms of the important factors around economic development and the importance that the Strategic Investment Program provides for this state and for local jurisdictions in the state. We disagree on this issue, quite frankly, and view it a little bit differently, as you might imagine. I don't want to do too much, but this it seems simple, but it's a little bit it is a little bit complicated. So I thought I would walk through a couple of things and get to some pictures, because in some ways the pictures do speak a thousand words in this case. So just quickly, the Strategic Investment Program is a 15-year property tax abatement. It's a partial property tax abatement in that it caps the assessed value for traded sector industries in urban area, in the urban category, at $100 million for the private project, and in rural areas at $25 million for the private project. And as you've heard, the definition of the rural area is tied to whether a piece of property was outside an urban growth boundary as of December 1st of 2002. So what's the problem with that? Well, the rural area definition hasn't changed in the last 10 years, while urban growth boundaries have. And I do want to take issue with one of the statements that was provided. This proposal is not an elimination of the Strategic Investment Program in this state. It is a redefinition of what is rural and what is subject to the $25 million cap in assessed value versus the $100 million cap in assessed value. So, and many cities in this state above 30,000 population that have added UGB land and might today have some land that's currently classified rural, even though it's inside the UGB, like Gresham and like Hillsborough, they'll still have access to the Strategic Investment Program as an economic development tool. It's a matter of what the assessed value cap will be. Will it be $25 million or $100 million? And in fact, within those jurisdictions, and this is part of the problem, it treats even within jurisdictions different properties differently. You can literally have properties across the street from each other. One was in the UGB in 1995. For SIP purposes, it's classified as urban, and across the street, a piece of property was added to the UGB in 2004, and it's classified rural within the same jurisdiction. And so not only does it create kind of tension between jurisdictions, but between property owners within jurisdictions, we think that's a problem. It is harder to attract economic development to brownfield sites that tend to be located in older parts of urban areas that have been in urban growth boundaries for a long time and already have challenges to attract economic development. So when it's easier for a project, because they get more of a tax benefit, to go out to the fringes, the areas of urban areas that have been added to the UGB most recently, it's harder to get that economic development activity into brownfields. And it's a different rural area definition than the enterprise zone program, the other property tax abatement program that's available in parts of the state. And as I'll show a little bit further on, it does expand the applicability of the Strategic Investment Program to smaller level investment projects within urban areas. And I think that was one of the points that Senator Burdick was getting at. So from an equity standpoint, just quickly, the urban strategic investment program versus the rural in the green, you can see for one example project, and keep in mind that this makes some assumptions about building value versus equipment value. This is within one taxing district, so tax rates will affect how much taxes and fees would be paid by the company. But the relative difference is the same, kind of from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. You can see the remarkable difference. Washington County has made a decision for their strategic investment program to not include land and building value in the cap. So the strategic investment program does allow that distinction. Washington County has chosen to do that, so that's why the urban strategic investment program minus land and building is slightly higher than the urban strategic investment program full on that. That's a decision they've made. We don't get to choose whether a piece of land is rural versus urban, however. In terms of expanding the applicability of the SIP, we kind of looked at the break-even point, if you will, between the enterprise zone program and the strategic investment program. And you can see that with the rural strategic investment program, the break-even point in Gresham for a Gresham project would be about $63.5 million. So projects smaller than that would benefit more from the enterprise zone program. Projects larger than that would benefit more under the rural strategic investment program. On the urban category, that break-even point is over $250 million project. So in essence, if we had a project coming to Gresham and we had a significant amount of land that was a rural category for a strategic investment program and it was $200 million, they would get much more benefit under the rural strategic investment program than under the enterprise zone program. And why that's important to you is because we have an agreement with the state about income tax revenue sharing. So expanding the applicability through the rural strategic investment program category to smaller level private investments means more revenue sharing. Good thing for us. We think there's value to gain share, but we don't think that was the intent of the legislature. Rural ought to be rural, urban ought to be urban. So just some quick pictures. We can play a little game, urban or rural. And I'll let you think about that as I flip through there. This happens to be designated urban. This is also designated urban, that large vacant piece of land. Anyone want to venture a guess?
What do you think?
This is urban within the city of Gresham. Industrial land, urban or rural? This is a bit of a trick question. The property on the left-hand side is rural under the SIP definition. That's the Genentech site. Across the street on the right-hand side is classified as urban under the current definition. And then just a little bit of an aerial to kind of demonstrate how the difference from property to property, even literally across the street from each other, exists, and kind of the disparity even for property owners. So just to wrap up, Mr. Chair, we believe the solution presented in Senate Bill 19 ensures that this powerful tool will still be available, but equitably applied within urban areas for properties that are similarly situated, that the modification brings the rural area SIP definition in line with the enterprise zone rural area definition. We believe that rural should mean rural and urban should mean urban, and that industrial land in Gresham and Hillsboro and Wilsonville shouldn't be treated the same as industrial lands in communities like Central Point, Coos Bay, Roseburg, Madras, Redmond, and many others across the state that also have industrial land that are trying to attract important industrial development to their cities. I thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Chair Roblin and committee members. I'm Travis Sovall, East Metro Economic Alliance Executive Director, and as an economic alliance, we certainly are fully supportive of incentives that bring business to the state of Oregon, because we understand and clearly appreciate the opportunity to operate on a not just national but international and global scale as we compete for jobs here in this great state of Oregon. As Ron mentioned, it does kind of pain us today to be in this conversation here in front of you, because ultimately we clearly see the Westside Economic Alliance as one of our partners, and we see the city of Hillsborough as one of our key partners in economic development across the region. As an organization, we've got members that clearly benefit directly from the development that has gone on in Hillsborough and Beaverton and on the west side in Washington County. So we certainly see the peripheral benefit of making sure that we do economic development here in our region. One of the things as an organization that we look at are the limited resources that we have in the state and some of the challenges that exist when we're starting to look at development on the fringes and on the edges of these new properties that come into the urban growth boundary that are actually called rural when they're in an urban setting. And what I mean by that specifically is that as we look at infrastructure, as we look at we're talking roads, and as we're talking infrastructure that feed the properties, we're actually beginning to give those new properties a much greater advantage than properties that have been greenfields that are ready to go, that have been inside the urban growth boundaries for a couple of decades. And that's challenging for us, because when we start to look at the pot of money and the pot of resources that exist within the region and within the state, we're challenged to think that those properties that have been and are available for development are going to suffer because of this inequity. And that's something that concerns us. And so I won't go into a lot of detail. Ron has done a phenomenal job in touching on this. You've heard some great testimony already. But I will say that it's those challenges that we're concerned about in regards to the competitive nature of limited resources and making sure that we're beginning to do development in areas that actually are considered urban. And, you know, some of the things that I consider, and I sit on the TriMet board, and one of the things that concerns me about wearing that hat is ultimately as we look at mass transit and we begin to actually start to service things on the fringes, that gets more expensive for us as an organization. So there are things that certainly concern us across many, many avenues when we start talking about the difference between urban and rural. But East Metro Economic Alliance certainly supports Senate Bill 19.
Questions for this panel? Senator Pozanski.
I guess I'm going to ask committee staff to maybe walk me through some of this, because what I see is some type of a feud between the two sides, and I'm trying to figure out where Hillsborough is going to be disadvantaged based on if we change the definition. I mean, is it somehow once we change the definition, whatever's already in place is going to be impacted?
No, it's the Genentech, it does have a portion of the bill that allows that to be grandfathered. So any of the property that it's on currently, if it wants to expand on the same portion of property, would still be in the rural SIP. It's just any new property, any new SIP that is formed has to have has to be entirely outside of the UGB with 19 accepted. Is that a? I think that's pretty much what I said. Not quite.
Mayor Willie, why don't you come on up here?
Yeah.
Thank you again, Chair, sure. Senator. In answer to your question, Hillsborough has 1,250 acres right now currently that will come out of the availability to use the rural SIP.
So just for discussion purposes, if there was a grandfather for, let's say, we're going to take the snapshot and look at everything that's been done under the current rules and grandfather that in, and then we set in a new set of rules for what's now going to be considered urban versus rural, how's that going to work?
Well, I'd have to look at that, but obviously
I got a thumbs up behind you already. I got a thumbs up behind you.
Yeah, we're most concerned right now of protecting that 1,250 acres, because we do have a pretty significant investment in how we've designated that strictly for. That's an industrial sanctuary, and we have made a commitment to Metro, and we've had it designated that way because it has to be large lot industrial zoning. So it is specifically designed for growth.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm just looking for that coexistence.
I agree. I appreciate that, because I think that's why we're here, actually, to figure that out, coexistence. Yes.
Mr. Chair, if you
yes,
would
please.
Allow me to address that
Absolutely.
Question, because I appreciate the effort to try to find coexistence in this case, but we may be the canola.
Well, we might have to get the Department of Ag to come in and help us
yeah,
with this.
I don't think that satisfies the issue for us, Mr. Chair, Senator Przanski. 1,250 acres, in fact, with this huge advantage over important industrial land in Gresham that would still be classified as urban because it's been in the UGB
right.
for longer. That has likewise been heavily invested in by the citizens of Gresham in infrastructure to help support economic development and attracting industrial development would continue to be disadvantaged compared to that 1,250 acres that's been most recently added to the urban growth boundary, the Portland urban growth boundary. So I think that's it. And quite frankly, if I was sitting in Mayor Willie's shoes and I had this advantage for 1,250 acres in Gresham, I'd probably be fighting to keep that advantage as well. I don't blame him for that. But we view this from a different perspective, and we think that this powerful tool ought to be equitably applied within the same urban area on lands that are very much the same, that are clearly urban lands.
Okay. I thank you all for that's great. We have one more person wants to come up, and that's Jim McCartley from Washington County. We're good.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Jim McCauley. I'll improve my penmanship
Thank
next
you.
Time.
I knew that, too.
It's okay. Government Affairs with Washington County. You've already heard plenty on this issue, and I don't want to dive into any particular details that you haven't already received. But we had a chance to meet with Gresham staff throughout the interim. And from our staff's perspective at Washington County and also the commission, they couldn't get to a point to be able to support what Gresham wants to do. So we would be opposing Senate Bill 19. Ultimately, it comes down to taking out a economic development tool and taking it physically off the table for one jurisdiction. So thank you.
Senator Przanski.
Yeah, I'm not getting it here because it
right.
seems to me this. I'm not saying we're going to go there.
Right.
But if we just took this snapshot in time and we understand and we recognize what Hillsborough has done and the position
right.
they're in, and you keep that there, that 1,200 whatever acres,
right.
and then you look at what Gresham wants and how they want to redefine it for the existing land, and we did that.
Right.
Then we just basically have two areas that are going to be able to compete because they've got the same economic development tools, what I'm thinking. But I don't know, you know, the good chair for revenue, how this works as to these type of tax incentives, et cetera.
Okay.
But the reality is,
well, there's 18 other cities that have done the same thing that has happened in the Hillsborough area.
And
so we'd have to look at the same thing.
Exactly.
But yeah, I agree. Yes.
I just have a question for our for Jim. I'm trying to think back to 2001 when this was passed, correct?
2002, I believe.
2002?
Or, it was one set. Yeah, you're right.
It should
one.
Have been one.
It was in one.
2000.
Okay.
Yeah.
It seemed to me we were trying to help rural communities that had been devastated by the loss of the timber industry with upwards of 70% of the mills closed. And so it was designed to help a certain rural counties to be able to recover from that. Is that correct or not?
I am not the best person because I wasn't actually lobbying this issue back in 2001. I was actually with the forest products industry at that time, oddly enough. I've repackaged myself over the last decade. But you know, the question over the magic of the year and things of that nature, I'm thinking that the legislature knew exactly what would qualify and what wouldn't physically qualify in terms of this economic development tool. And I think they wanted to provide maximum opportunity out there to communities throughout Oregon, and that's why this impact is beyond just Hillsborough.
Yeah,
and
Mr. Chair,
yes,
I think Senator Close really raised the issue that I was trying to get at, and that is that this was meant to be a rural incentive to encourage some of our very struggling rural communities, and it's become kind of a war between the East and the West here, but I think there's a missing voice here, and that is people from the rural communities. We're not hearing from them, and I would very much like, if anyone's out there, I would very much like to hear their perspective on this, because this goes far, this is a much bigger issue than just Hillsborough versus Gresham.
I would tell you that in the few conversations I've had with some of the rural, they said if we could find a $25 million property investment, we'd love to give them a sip. But we don't get a whole lot of people coming with $25 million investments. It is limited in use in the rural areas very often. There's a few projects in our area that would meet this one, and we'd love to see them happen.
Very few.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would it be prudent that the committee here looks in to see what the intent of the legislature was
back
then?
Yeah, we can look at that.
And get that part cleared up and then move from there.
We'll get some more information. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And is there anyone else that has been sitting back there wanting to testify and they couldn't find a sheet to sign up on and feel that they really need to do this? I see no one. So we will close our public hearing on Senate Bill 19. And we thank everybody for their input. And we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 331. And we'll have a short explanation by our administrator while I invite our Senator Johnson, Senator Thompson up first.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 331 increases the percentage of money to be deposited in account for county park and recreation sites from 35% to 50% of monies transferred from the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department from registration of trailers, campers, and motorhomes, and from recreational vehicle trip permits. This would be effective on July 1st, 2013.
And we have the rest of our little group that we have. I think they've been meeting for a little while. We've been excited about that, and so they're all aligned here as well. So with that, Senator Johnson.
Thank you. For the record, Betsy Johnson, Senator from District 16, co-chief sponsor, along with Senator Thompson.
Along with Senator Thompson, District 26, we have, I've noticed we have many of our county commissioners here today.
Yes, we do.
So welcome all of them.
Mr. Chair, I am delighted to report that we think we have struck a deal. We have asked Commissioner Tucker to be our spokesmodel, and he will be sharing with the committee what our plan is.
Do we refer to him as Vanna or what?
We appreciate your new title.
Chair Roblin and committee members, I usually wear jeans and a shirt and tie, so she has not recognized me in my suit. Thank you for the opportunity to come before you today. We had a brief meeting in the hallway. We've actually had lunch meetings, and we think we have a possibility identified some ways where state parks and the counties can work to a common agreement on the proration of RV fees. And that might mean an amendment. It might mean a slight change to the percentages. So we're asking if you could and would give us two things today. One, reschedules for 1 week from today, same time, 3:00. Allow us to come back before you and to present the results of the work that Director Parks, the co-chairs, and the counties represented by both OPA and AOC can come together and reach on a common fee and not have a food fight. I'm sorry, not to debate that issue before you. But we'd also like to ask, we've had some citizens as well as park directors drive from a long distance in the state. There are a couple who would like very much, with your indulgence, to still be able to speak today. They're going to modify their presentations.
Name for the record.
William Tucker, Linn County Commissioner.
Thank you very much. No problem.
I thought spokes model was good enough.
Yeah, I know.
We asked that they be allowed to ask if a couple of them would like
absolutely
to speak. I think there's about three that would like to. Any questions for the group of us that are smiling, thinking that we have a possible agreement?
I mean, does anybody else in the group need to say anything, or are we okay? Okay.
I guess
time and all.
My thing is we've already posted out there for next Thursday, a week from today. We will be glad to put you on, but the assumption is it will not take very long because you will have a great, there you go.
Absolutely.
You will have a great answer to the question, so we won't have to adjust our whole schedule except to add you to it.
Chair Roblin, we are hoping to bring forward the corrected and amended bill that we'll have the resounding support of your committee as well as the interested parties.
Okay.
But we have it.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we have a deal in concept. Everybody's
right.
just running the numbers. We're just doing a little double-checking to make sure we don't do anything in error, but we've got a deal.
And I guess the other question I would ask, it's probably going to take an amendment, and I know you have senators available so who can get that done, but if we haven't gotten to that point, we do have a free schedule on the following Tuesday, so we have some latitude with respect to
Tuesday.
Would you rather do it the following Tuesday?
No.
Oh.
Thursday.
2 seconds.
Thursday, they want only 2 seconds.
Okay.
Meaning 2 minutes.
We got you. We're doing that for you.
Yeah.
But if you don't have all the amendments
Keep
and stuff ready.
Keep the pressure on.
That's right. Okay. Then any questions from the rest of the committee for this group?
No, Mr. Chair, I just want the record to show that I like the original bill.
So. Senator Burdick, thank you very much.
So I will, I do want to invite these people who came, some of them more than 100 miles, so if are there enough, well, if you don't take all the chairs away, are there enough chairs for all those people that want to come up and say a few things while they're here? Come on up, and you identify yourself as you come on to come up here. So I think it's Larry Robinson, Doreen Ferguson, Gary Groth, and Dell, is it? I should know this person, too, because he's from Tillamook. Dell.
Why don't we do three, and then we'll get another
That's
three.
That's true. Yeah. The first three up, and then the next three Senate sit back there and be ready to go. These are the 400 milers.
Can you start?
Yeah. These are the 400 milers. So, again, thank you for coming all the way, too. It is really appreciated. So, whoever wants to start?
Chair Roblin, committee, thank you for the opportunity to come before you today. My name is Mike Russell. I'm Lane County Parks Manager. And just wanted to let you know that this is an important item for us. Just and I'm glad the deal is going through, and we're excited about seeing how that goes through. I just want to speak from my heart a little bit to you this afternoon. So when this opportunity came up, it was more, we've been in a reduction mode in our budgets for over 8 years, and every year it's a struggle to meet the needs that we continually have and are deferring and continue to defer. And honestly, this was a spot of light for us, and we really encourage you to support the bill and whatever amendment may come forward.
You don't have to get too close. It picks up pretty well.
Chair Roblin and members of the committee, again, thank you for letting us speak here this afternoon. My name is Gary Groth. I'm the director of the Douglas County Parks Department. And I'll echo what Mike had to say. This is a really potentially excellent bill for our department. We've been struggling, as you know, Southern Oregon, rural counties have been struggling with our budgets for years. Our Parks Department budget has been cut 45% since 2005. Yet we feel a really important role in the recreation of the people of our state, the county parks, and you'll hear this theme, I think, from here on in, is that we supply and fill a need that isn't met by the Oregon, the State Parks Department, and Douglas County is a real example of that, in that we don't have any state parks in Douglas County. All the parks in our county are either federal or provided by the county. We have 52 developed parks, and right now I have on my field staff, I have 6 people and a mechanic, and it's a real struggle. And so this is a real opportunity for us, and I strongly urge you to support it. And thank you very much.
And you have a lot of territory, because you go from the Cascades to the ocean.
It's the size of Connecticut, 5,000 square miles. Yeah, it's a long way to go.
Senator Roblin and committee members, thank you so much for this opportunity. My name is Doreen Ferguson, Josephine County Parks Manager. Hi. 1995, Josephine County Parks was taken off the county budget, and in that way we get no general funds, no tax dollars whatsoever. During those years, when they did receive money from the general fund, there were 27 to 30 full-time employees. I now have 5 and a part-time person. It's quite a difference, and however, the population has grown, the use of the parks continues to grow, and actually the first parks were developed about the time I was born, and then the same poly pipe is running under the ground, and so we chase leaks day in and day out, and we're doing our best and doing a really good job keeping beautiful park system going. But I will tell you that the public does not differentiate between county parks and state parks, particularly in our county. Like Douglas County, we really don't have a lot of state representation and none in terms of campgrounds. So any increase in revenue for us is, it's just critical. We literally have to make decisions between, you know, we always go with toilet paper, but, you know, with between that and a picnic table. So we really, really do need
And this money that has been coming from this tax, has it all gone directly to parks and not been taken as other parts of the general fund? Will this money go directly to the parks?
100%
goes to parks. That's what my understanding too. So
that's correct.
Okay, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to springboard with Noreen. Of course, that's my neck of the woods. I don't know how they do the job. We've got some fantastic parks down there in Josephine County, very, very popular parks. And also, she takes care of one or two cemeteries, too, don't you?
A cemetery.
Yeah, so she's got her hands full, and she keeps it going. It's
long-term
amazing.
Long-term parks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Permanent parks.
We don't have a lot of trouble with those park users.
We have one on my old campus at the high school, so we always felt.
I did want to add just one point, and that was in 1993, which is a long time ago, Dr. Darrell Olson did a study on fishing and just on the Rogue River. And Rogue River is the sixth busiest waterway in the state of Oregon. At that time, there was about $17.3 million generated into businesses, and that was for fishing licenses, food, hotels, restaurants, you know, those just things that when people come fishing that they need. Certainly all that money didn't come to our parks. I wish it did. But Josephine County Parks does have 80% of public access to the Rogue River, which makes us a major stakeholder in that and I think critical to the economic health of our county. I think we're done.
Oh, Senator Burke. Sugar.
Doreen, I really appreciate you driving all the way up here today to testify. Thank you.
Thank you.
And to be a part of the conversation, so thank you for that, too.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Oh, and I should say thanks to my constituents, both the gentlemen within the district.
Oh, that's true.
Thank you.
Thanks. So is there any others that want to come up? Three more seats. We'll just let you come on up in whatever order you want. And as you can see, there's a seat available. So, yeah, very good. And be sure to identify yourself for the record, and whoever wants to start.
I'll go. Chairman Robin, committee members, my name is Larry Robison, and I'm the Coos County Parks Director. I'm up here probably because I've been at this since 1972. I started out as a summer seasonal employee, so I got a kind of a firsthand knowledge of what has happened since 1972, you know, in the county park system. Fortunately, I was there long enough that they couldn't find anybody else to take over as director, so I'm at that now, too. So anyway, just to give the committee a brief little, when we started our park system in 1966, it was set up, you know, mainly for the local citizens of Coos County. We did it, you know, it was rough at best, and a number of the facilities were actually constructed by the county road department at the time. We took those over, and then in that process, most of our revenue, of course, came from the general fund, which was, of course, generated by the timber revenue. As that slowly decreased, we looked at other ways in order to do that. When the original RV legislation was passed, that was an opportunity for us then to kind of wean ourselves off of those general fund and timber dollars. And then that initially was, I think, 5%. And then Representative Witte, at that time, working with a group, got it up to the 30% area where it was, and then A couple of years ago, we did the increase of 5%. So that's kind of where we're at. Right now, we're currently off the general fund as of about 3 years ago. We still have to go back and ask for a loan from time to time, just depending on what happens. But we started out, when I started, we had about 45 seasonal employees and 10 full-time. And then we went up to as high as 16 full-time employees. Now we're down to 9. And 2 of those are, one is me, the office, and my office manager. So we actually have 7 people left in the field to manage 35 facilities. So anything that comes about of this of increase of RV dollars would greatly benefit Coos County and keep us from, as I stated in my written presentation, allow us then to go back and upkeep some of the ones that have been, the management on those, the amount of dollars to put back in them to keep them up to current standards will help us do that. So thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Glenn Crinklaw. I'm the representative for Columbia County, and specifically I want to talk as the parks director for our county parks agency. Our county is fully behind passage of this Senate bill. Columbia County is like many other rural counties in the state of Oregon. We've had our fair share of blows to our economic midsection over the past decade or so, and we've unfortunately been recipients of a couple natural disasters that just added to our overall difficulties. In many of our communities within our county are on pretty wobbly economic legs, as we meet today. The one bright spot, I think, in this otherwise gloomy picture are the park properties that Columbia County possesses. But a lot of things in Columbia County, it's got a bit of a ragged edge. And it's been, largely related to, the tight, financial conditions that, a rural county is, finds itself in. But being a county on, bordered on, side by 2 of our wealthiest, counties in the state, we see huge opportunity. And, but most importantly, for our own citizens, we'd like to see the same camping opportunity that our state parks provides to their visitors. And this particular bill, we believe, gives us that tool to bring our facilities up to that standard, and we strongly encourage you to support that.
Thank you.
Chair Roblin and committee members, my name is Patricia Hoover. I'm from Eugene. I'm a native Oregonian, a proud native Oregonian, and I am a citizen volunteer committee member on the Lane County Parks Advisory Committee. And I have seen in the last few years the agonizing discussions over funding for our parks in Lane County, and I've heard about all counties throughout the state. And I'm here as a parks user, as an outdoor enthusiast that loves our state, and realizes we really need to all share in what we're providing our citizens and our visitors. And I'll tell you, park users do not go out there and know which parks have been given what percentage of what budget. They just want clean, well-maintained, usable parks for a positive recreational experience. So I am very much behind the passage of the Senate bill, however it's modified. And I speak for my PAC and Eugene, who also is very much behind having more equity in how the states and counties share their funding. Thank you very much for your time and having us here.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Thank you for being here. So is there anyone else in the audience that would love to come and testify to this one? Please come on up forward and take a seat.
I would love to.
Okay.
Chair Roblin and members of the committee, my name is Steve Lambert. I'm the Jackson County Parks Manager and the President of the Oregon Parks Association, who's been working with AOC on this bill. First of all, I'm going to keep this short. I know you're at the end of your day. I just want to say thank you. Thank you for letting these dedicated individuals who were up here before us speak. You've heard some woes, some budget woes, and I'm sure this committee hears budget woes quite often. But what you also heard was the fact that we have six folks who just drove at great lengths to spread the word of what they do and the importance of what they do, and people who firmly believe that county parks play an important role at the local level. Throughout these budget challenges, I am convinced that county park managers across the state have not been looking at this solely with the negative glasses on. We've been looking at these funding challenges as a challenge and an opportunity to increase efficiency, see what we can do better, see how we can better use public dollars, see how we can collaborate with other jurisdictions and other recreation providers. So I want to end on a positive note that we've done good things in tough times and largely remain with a good set of parks for our public to use throughout the state. Lastly, I'd like to thank Director Tim Wood from Oregon State Parks. He was part of the discussions earlier today, and I appreciate the fact that he came out and willing to discuss this bill and see what he can do for counties.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, my name is Jerome Cook. I'm the Clackamas County Parks and Forest Manager, and I'd just like to briefly add that I appreciate your flexibility today in letting us caucus out in the hallway, move toward a resolution, and the opportunity to be rescheduled for next week to come back to you for further consideration on this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay, any question? Anybody else that would like to come up? I guess I do want to say to you, as well as all the rest of the crowd, I am really pleased personally to see the progress that's gone. I know State Parks only cares about making sure their parks are as good as they can be, and we have saddled them with a number of other responsibilities, including our great grounds here at the Capitol, which they are now a state park. Wasn't something they asked for. We just thought it would be really great to have it taken care of. Our state fair, which I feel very strongly about, which has not been an easy burden, is another one. So there's a lot of things that resources are necessary to keep things going. And the fact that we could have a conversation today with a lot of the people that came, all of whom want to do the same thing. They want to provide amazing experiences for our own citizens and people who come and visit our state. And I look at, you know, raising my kids in Coos County and all the parks that I had an advantage to take of, that most of the ones we went to actually were state parks. There's some federal, but a lot of state and county parks, and most of them were county. In Douglas County, if you go just down the street, there's a great parks in Winchester Bay. And Myrtle Point, I mean, a lot of the things that the memories that were formed in our family come from those county parks. And I know that our state park people believe the same thing, and so it was really nice to see something come together today, and I appreciate the work, Tim, of your agency and working with all these other people as well. So, thank you. Any...
Makes our job easier.
It does make our job easier. Any further comments? Then we will close our public hearing on Senate Bill 331, and I want to say thanks to everybody, and our business is concluded, so... We will conclude the hearing of the Rural Communities and Economic Development Committee.